suburb of Eastlake, mistakenly referred to him as a SEAL because of his work on the staff of a SEAL flag officer, Howard never corrected them. Admiral Pilsner treated him like a trusted ally, and together they wielded the full power and influence of the U.S. Navy against anyone who stood in their way. It was very much us versus them. Pilsner's political connections had made him a likely candidate to run the Pentagon, and Howard would rise alongside him as his most trusted confidant. Captain Howard had an appointment that morning and would be arriving to work at WARCOM later than usual. Most men his age were long past the stage of needing braces on their teeth, but Howard's teeth had been in such horrible shape from a lifetime of neglect that his wife had finally convinced him to do something about it. She secretly hoped it would help his chronic halitosis as well as his appearance. The Navy denied his application to have braces put on, citing the purely cosmetic reason of his request. Unfortunately for him, the same bureaucracy in which he prospered could also be an insurmountable hurdle to climb. He shelled out the money to pay for the braces himself and had a regular visit with his civilian orthodontist out in the suburbs. He turned off his cell phone during the office visit per the sign on the door, powering it back up as he walked outside to what they now called a sports activity vehicle. His Navy-issued BlackBerry came alive with every conceivable alert when he turned it on, and it reconnected to the network. Voicemails, text messages, and emails had all come through while his device had been turned off. He scanned the emails first and stopped in his tracks as he opened the most recent message. Explosion at WARCOM, 2 dead, evacuate immediately. He checked the voicemail from his deputy, a wave of nausea coming over him, when he heard the news that Admiral Pilsner had been killed by an explosion in his office, likely a terrorist attack. He immediately hit his local news app to see if there was more updated information available. Heart pounding, blinking to clear his vision, Howard tried to fight back what felt like an anxiety attack as he read the headline in shock. Local moderate Islamic leader decapitated in brutal hate crime. Instantly clicking on the link, he read, San Diego Imam Hamadi Ismail Massoud was murdered late last night in an apparent hate crime. His decapitated head was found this morning by neighbors, impaled on the spike of a wrought iron gate to the mosque where he lived and served as the director of Islamic services for the Islamic Center for Peace and Prosperity of Southern California. Without hesitation, he dialed his wife's mobile number. Amy, listen to me. Don't talk. Go get the kids out of school right now and take them to the airport. I'll meet you there. No, I don't have time to explain, and yes, it has to do with what you're seeing on the news. Gerald is dead. We have to go now. I'll meet you at the ticket counter. Throw some warm weather clothes in a bag and go. Leonard Howard climbed into his BMW X3 and sped out of the parking lot towards San Diego International Airport. Chapter 55. Alpine, California. By the time the news of the explosion broke, Reese was on the road to the town of Alpine in the mountains northeast of San Diego. 40 minutes later, he was winding his way up the dirt road toward the canyon, a private, 1,000-yard rifle range owned by his friend, Clint Harris. Harris had hoped to turn the site, built on an old runway high in the hills, into a full training complex for military and law enforcement use. Unfortunately, he'd been sued by environmental groups and tied up in litigation ever since. He could still use the range for private guests. He just couldn't run it as a business until the lawsuits were settled. Harris was a smart and successful businessman and was no joke with a rifle. He had spent time behind the scope in Southeast Asia, and even at 68 years of age, he could still match and often surpass the skills of Reese's top snipers. He loved having Reese and his operators up to the range to train so he could test himself against the best. Harris was also an off-the-grid kind of guy and had no great love for the federal government. When Reese had approached him with this ask, he agreed without hesitation. Even though Harris didn't have a family, he risked imprisonment and financial ruin if he were ever discovered to have aided Reese's escape. Reese knew the combinations to both gates en route to the compound and steered directly toward the open roll-up garage door where Harris stored and maintained the vehicles used on the training site. Harris backed a Polaris Ranger utility vehicle up to the tailgate of Reese's cruiser and was busy transferring gear, including a parting gift from Marco, from the cruiser to the Ranger, before Reese could get the vehicle into park. Marco had his driver deliver a backpack filled with $100,000 in multiple denominations of U.S. currency soon after their Mexico excursion, so that Reese would not be able to refuse it. Inside was a handwritten note reading, "Just in case you need traveling money, my friend. Keep the change. Marco." Reese jumped out alongside Harris and helped him continue loading the heavy Pelican weapons cases and bags into the bed of the Ranger. "Can't thank you enough for this, Clint. I mean it."
"You do it for me, Reese. That's all that matters. Now say goodbye to your girlfriend here. I promise it'll be a quick death."
Reese patted his beloved Land Cruiser to say goodbye after many years of faithful service. He knew that it would be gone by sunrise the next morning, probably at the bottom of the nearby Loveland Reservoir. Harris pulled the chains to lower the garage door, and they both climbed into the Ranger. The noise of the Polaris's engine made it too loud to talk as they drove the short distance out to the range. There wasn't much to say anyway. Harris stopped at the north corner of the long, flat range and pulled a Motorola radio from his belt.
"Tighter, this is the canyon. Do you read me?"
"I've got you, Canyon. I'm 5 minutes out," replied a female voice with a southern accent that was discernible even over the scratchy radio signal.
"Roger, we're ready for you here. You got light winds from the west, less than 3 miles per hour. Range is clear."
"Roger, Canyon. See you in 5.
"There she is."
Harris pointed to a speck on the horizon directly to the north. As the speck grew closer, Reese could hear the humming sound of a turboprop. The aircraft flew directly over their position before making a sweeping turn that put it in line with the opposite end of the old 1,000-yard runway. With the gears folded down and locked, and with the flaps at full extension, the pilot put the Pilatus PC-12NG down just ahead of the impact berm, taking advantage of every foot of available runway. The sleek, single-engine aircraft was painted silver and looked very much like a bird of prey. The plane's deceleration was rapid, and within 700 yards of the landing spot, the plane was taxiing at normal speed. The pilot passed the men in the Polaris and turned the plane 180 degrees, pointing the nose back in the direction it had come from. The plane came to a stop, and the engine's RPMs decreased audibly as it went into ground idle, the engine continuing to run with the props feathered so as not to create any thrust. A few seconds later, the engine shut off, and the prop began to slow. Almost immediately, the cabin door on the left side of the aircraft folded downward, and all 5 feet 5 inches of Liz Riley stood in the cabin door. She was wearing aviator sunglasses, and her hair was pulled back into a ponytail, covered by a crimson University of Alabama ball cap. She looked like she'd walked out of a CrossFit class instead of the cockpit of an aircraft, wearing a gray tank top and tight black nylon yoga pants. Her shoulders and arms were muscular without being masculine, courtesy of the gym addiction born during the rehab from her wartime injuries. Her right shoulder and part of her right arm were highlighted in a mural of intricate tattoos. She hopped swiftly down the steps of the Pilatus and embraced Reese in a bear hug.
"I'm so sorry about everything, Reese. I really am."
Reese returned the hug firmly, Liz being the closest thing to a sister he'd ever had.
"Your turn to save my ass, Liz."
"Gladly. Let's get your gear loaded and get you out of here."
Liz grabbed one of the kit bags and ran up the steps into the aircraft's cabin. She set the bag down and stood in the door.
"Y'all hand that stuff up to me. I need to get the balance right."
The men began offloading the Ranger's utility bed onto the deck of the aircraft, while Riley placed the various bags and cases in spots of her choosing. She wasn't the kind of girl whom you offered to help with the bags. She stood at the front of the cabin, pointing at the various items of kit as she made calculations in her head.
"Okay, boys, we're loaded. Get in, Reese."
Reese embraced Harris in a half-handshake, half-hug.
"See you when you get back," Harris said.
Reese nodded with a look that was unmistakable in its meaning.
"I'm not coming back."
Then he climbed the steps into the cabin. Liz pointed at his seat in the cockpit, and he pulled the stairway door up, securing it. She climbed nimbly into the left seat, put on her headset, and talked herself through a rapid pre-flight checklist. Satisfied, she started the engine and ran the throttle up to full power, watching the tachometer rise. With the engine screaming, she released the wheel brakes and applied pitch to the spinning propeller blades. The aircraft surged forward, pushing Reese back into his seat as it accelerated down the dirt strip. 700 yards from their starting point, Liz pulled back on the yoke, and the nose pointed rapidly skyward. The Pilatus cleared the impact berm by a healthy margin and gained altitude as the landing gear retracted into the fuselage. Liz turned the aircraft east and spoke for the first time since she'd assumed the controls.
So, where to, Reese?
Chapter 56. Capstone Capital Corporate Offices, Los Angeles, California. Horn had his assistant arrange the video conference in the same frosted glass room at Capstone where he'd hosted J.D. Hartley. This time, it was Secretary Hartley calling, and it would take all of his negotiating skills to talk her down. He had to keep this deal on the rails, or everything would be lost. The large LCD screen went from solid blue to an image of the secretary's conference room at the Pentagon. One of Hartley's aides confirmed that the video was live and then exited the camera's view, presumably to summon the secretary herself. Lorraine Hartley, without professional makeup and lighting, was not a pretty sight, and the video image did not help bolster her appearance. She looked exhausted and stressed. Clearly, she was not happy with the way things had spun out of control.
Horn, I cannot believe that I let you and J.D. talk me into this thing. Pilsner is dead, Steve. Blown out of his office window like confetti, and one of my best fundraisers is dead with him.
Madam Secretary, I am deeply saddened by the loss of the Admiral and Mike. Both were great men.
Oh, save me the condolence act, Horn. They were hardly great men. All I care about is this thing staying under the radar. And with the bodies piling up, that is not what is happening.
Madam Secretary, I understand why you're upset. I really do. These are setbacks to be sure, but let's be honest. Those men had served their purpose on this project. We now have less equity to share, and better yet, a platform to catapult you into the White House. This is your moment, Madam Secretary.
What are you talking about? How is this mess going to do anything other than land me in prison?
No one is going to prison, Lorraine. This is exactly the kind of issue that you need to establish yourself as a strong leader. Don't let that lame duck president be the face of this thing. Call a primetime press conference and tell the public about James Reese, the terrorist. He'll have every Hicktown cop in the country chasing him, and we know he won't let them take him alive. You'll look like you're already in the Oval Office, and you can use it to pass that domestic surveillance bill that you've been trying so desperately to get through Congress. The public will be scared shitless, and you'll be their savior.
You make a good point, Steve. We could really capitalize on this. But how do we know Reese isn't coming after us?
I have an asset that I've been holding in reserve, Lorraine, who can lead him right to his own demise. Get your best military or law enforcement units to hunt him down and tighten the noose, and my guys can finish the job. We give credit to whoever you want to owe you one, and we move forward with the next round of trials. This thing is going to work, Lorraine. You're going to be president, and we're going to make billions. With a B.
I'm giving you one last shot on this, Horn. This had better work, or I'll make sure you never see another dollar out of this agency's budget.
It will work, Lorraine. Trust me. Chapter 57. Riley had flown VFR out of North Las Vegas Airport, where she had returned in order to file a flight plan back to her home field in Texas. So long as she obeyed the visual flight rules, no one would question where she flew or, more important, where she'd landed. Once they were back on the ground in Nevada, Reese stayed in the cockpit wearing a hat and sunglasses while Riley filed her flight plan and supervised the refueling of the aircraft. Liz got permission from the North Vegas tower to take off, and they began the long trek to East Texas. Reese trusted Liz Riley in a way he trusted few, if any, other people in his life. He hadn't told the whole story from start to finish to anyone, and doing so took up most of the nearly 4-hour flight. He started at the beginning, during the peculiar pre-mission planning before the ambush, all the way through the tragic events that followed. He told her about the tumors, the unauthorized clinical trial, and the involvement of the Hartleys. He told her how he'd created the list and had been working his way down it as efficiently as possible. The truth was, Reese wasn't a cold-blooded killer, and he needed Riley's moral compass to lean on. He wanted to ensure that he was doing the right thing, the thing that would make his men and his family proud. Liz was a good listener, never interrupting, letting Reese's discourse serve as his confessional. It was not lost on Reese or on Liz that he was transforming into an insurgent. His methods of killing, blending his skills as an operator with the lessons he had learned over his years in special operations, studying terrorists, guerrillas, subversives, and assassins. If he had spent time thinking about it, he would have realized that his physical transformation matched the psychological one taking place within. He had raided the armory of his enemy and adopted clothes to blend into the populace, his long hair and beard making him look more like a logger from Oregon than a military man. Reese had always taken a hard line against prisoner abuse, regardless of what atrocity that prisoner had just committed. Even in the hardcore world of the SEAL teams, they were called anything but prisoners, detainees being the more polite term, though Reese always thought that sounded more like what cops did at traffic stops than what happened in war. As soon as they were flex-tied, their safety became the responsibility of the troop. Reese had no tolerance for any violence against the enemy once they were cuffed and under his control. It was one of the things that differentiated the United States from the enemy. Now, Reese had violated that most basic tenet of warfare, executing a man on his knees in Mexico. He had desecrated the body of the dead imam and left his head impaled on a spike in front of the mosque, forced another conspirator to wear a suicide vest onto a military installation to assassinate a high-ranking officer, murdered a federal agent while he slept, put a long-range projectile through the brain of an accountant, and tortured an attorney before intentionally overdosing him on narcotics. All that was prologue. He was not yet finished merging his highly honed abilities as a warfighter with the guerrilla tactics used against larger, more conventional militaries by terrorists the world over. His skills were the perfect fusion of elite special operator and cunning insurgent.
Reese, you are the strongest man that I've ever met, and I grew up around enough real men to know the difference. You've done it right, your entire career, your entire life, and you don't deserve any of this. Lord knows that Lauren and sweet Lucy didn't deserve it. Most would have cracked under that pressure and crawled into a hole. I hope you don't regret anything that you've done to avenge your family and your men, because as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing that you could do to these monsters that would be over the top. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't think about your risking your life to save my butt in Iraq. I will land this damn plane in Lorraine Hartley's front yard if that's what I need to do to help you.
I hope you don't think less of me, but I can't let these people get away with this, he said with intensity.
Reese, have I ever told you about my grandfather?
No, I don't think so. Your dad's dad?
No, my mother's daddy. He was the county sheriff back home. He was murdered in cold blood by some shitbag who'd just gotten out of jail. This was back in 1977, before I was even born. The guy that killed him sat on death row getting 3 squares a day for 30 years. Then some appellate court decides that he's ineligible for the death penalty. These big city Harvard lawyers line up to defend murderers like him. Who's sticking up for us? I never got to meet my grandfather, and our family will never get justice. Your teammates, those Rangers, the pilots and air crew, none of those guys will get to hug their wives, coach their sons' Little League games, or walk their daughters down the aisle. One of those 160th pilots, Chief Hansen, went to flight school with me. We all called him Swede because he looked like a huge Viking. He wanted to be an attack pilot, but he couldn't fit in anything other than a Chinook. He had a wife and 3 boys at home. He'd never even met his youngest, born just before he was killed on deployment. He was too mission critical, to get emergency leave. My heart breaks for his wife and those boys. You'll never get to see Lauren or Lucy again, or even meet your son. The system will protect the Hartleys, and they'll keep getting richer and more powerful. She'll be in the White House, and you'll still be trying to get people to believe your crazy conspiracy theory. No, Reese. If you're looking for someone to tell you you're doing something sinful, you've come to the wrong place. You hunt down every one of these fuckers and do justice for your family and all those warriors' families. She paused. Kill them, Reese. Kill them all.
Unsure how to respond, Reese remained silent as Liz collected her thoughts.
I'll do anything that I can to help, she said softly.
Thanks, Liz. You're doing enough already. I hate it that you're sticking your neck out this far for me. Sooner or later, they're going to figure out that you were involved.
Maybe they will, maybe they won't. Whatever happens, it'll be better than getting tortured and gang-raped by a bunch of jihadis in Iraq. Pretty sure the FBI can't cut my head off. I owe you my life, Reese. And besides, y'all are like family. They murdered the closest things to a sister and a niece I've ever had.
Chapter 58 Ghost Rose Ranch, Texas. Liz Riley's employer kept both of his planes in a hangar on his ranch between Houston and College Station. Liz lived on the property in a small but well-appointed and clean cabin, which would be Reese's home until he could figure out his next move. Only a skeleton crew of staff were on the ranch with the boss out of town, and none of them would bother Miss Riley's guest. She landed the Pilatus on the paved private airstrip and taxied toward a hangar that looked as clean as an operating room.
"Welcome to Ghost Rose Ranch," she said,
shutting down the engine and beginning her post-flight checklist while Reese climbed back into the passenger cabin.
"Just leave your gear in the plane if you want to. No one will bother it,"
Liz called from the cockpit. Reese nodded and found a small overnight bag that contained some clothes and toiletries, then opened the hatch and let down the stairs. He was desperate to stand on solid ground and stretch his legs after spending half the day in the small airplane. He paced around the hangar as Liz attended to the plane. Eventually, she too climbed down the stairs and went through a series of stretches to loosen up her stiff body. "How's your back?" Reese asked, referring to the injury that had ended her career as an Army aviator.
"It's okay. It gets stiff when I spend all day in the plane, though. Nothing that a glass of Pinot Grigio won't fix."
She flew like a man but drank like a girl. Reese always thought her to be an odd paradox of tomboy and girly girl, and he was constantly surprised by things that she said or did that made her seem too much of either one or the other. A Ford F-350 King Ranch truck pulled up in front of the hangar, and a small man in a western shirt, jeans, and boots tipped his Stetson to Liz and nodded his head at Reese.
"Señora Riley?"
"That's Ernesto," said Liz. "He'll drive us to my place. Don't worry. He knows how to keep his mouth shut."
They climbed into the pickup, and Reese took in the sights of the sprawling ranch as they made the 10-minute drive to Riley's cabin. Isla Mirada, Florida. It had cost Leonard Howard a fortune, but he had been able to get himself and his family on a red-eye flight from San Diego to Atlanta and then down to Fort Lauderdale, where they rented a car for the drive to Isla Mirada in the Florida Keys. They arrived at the rental house exhausted but happy to be safe and as far away from San Diego as the U.S. borders allowed. That nut job Reese had to be operating without any kind of support, and there was no way he'd be able to make his way across the country without being captured. Besides, how would he ever find them here with no intel assets? Howard and his family had lain low the first day and caught up on sleep, but now they were growing more comfortable with their tropical surroundings and were beginning to explore a bit. His teenage son and daughter complained at first about the lack of a beach near the house, but quickly realized that a world of aquatic wonders lay just below the water's surface, among the flats and reefs that made the Keys a snorkeling and diving destination. Howard bought them snorkeling gear at a local dive shop, and they spent most of the day exploring their new world. Leonard and his wife were satisfied sitting on the porch and reading. She read architectural and interior design magazines while he read a new Brad Thor novel he'd picked up in the Atlanta airport. This is the way they'd live the rest of their lives once he cashed in on what he and the late Admiral Pilsner simply called the project. Ghost Rose Ranch, Texas. Reese followed Liz up the steps of her cabin and into the small living room.
"Can I get you anything?"
she asked as she headed for the kitchen.
"I've got beer, wine, water. Not much else."
"I'll take a beer, I guess. And maybe some lights? This place is like a cave," Reese said, squinting at the photos on the mantle. There were pictures of Liz in her flight suit in front of her Kiowa in what was obviously Iraq. One of her father pinning on her wings at flight school graduation, and another that stopped him short. Liz, along with Reese, Lauren, and Lucy, all smiles at Christmas. Happiness frozen in time. Liz walked back into the living room carrying a bottle of Coors Light for Reese and a glass of white wine for herself.
"I finally get a man back to my place, and he's the one non-family member I can't have fun with."
Reese quickly recovered and pulled himself away from the photo. "Are family members off limits where you come from? I didn't realize that," he joked.
"I'm from Alabama, asshole, not Tennessee."
Riley punched Reese on the upper arm as she sat down on the couch next to him.
"You can use my Wi-Fi if you need it. We can't get a landline out here, so it's all via satellite. I think it's secure, but I can't promise anything. You know how risky that stuff is these days. I got 3 prepaid phones for you as well. I wouldn't use any of them more than once if I were you."
"Okay, thanks." It was risky, but necessary. Reese connected to the Wi-Fi signal and checked his Spider Oak folder for a message from Ben Edwards. He found one that was nothing more than a series of numbers and letters followed by JAG. It took Reese a moment to realize that the characters were grid coordinates and that Ben was leading him to a loose end, one of the few remaining names on his list.
"What do you have there?"
Liz asked. "A message from Ben," Reese responded. "Looks like it's the location of my next target."
"Good old Ben,"
Liz said, reminiscing.
"I remember him hitting on me constantly when I visited you and Lauren out in Coronado. I think he had just been picked up by the agency. He always gave me the creeps. I think he was married at the time, and his wife was right there."
"Sounds like Ben. He always had a bit of trouble with those wedding vows."
"Where's the target?"
Liz asked. "Florida, the Keys." The problem was getting there. It was the most bottlenecked spot in the United States, with one road in and out and surrounded by water on all sides. If this were a SEAL mission, the water would be the easy way in. They could use aircraft, a larger vessel, or even a submarine to drop him and his men in CRRC Zodiac boats offshore, where they'd ride as far as they could before swimming in silently below the surface, using closed-circuit breathing apparatus gear that left no telltale bubbles to give away their positions. The irony was that despite being a highly trained maritime commando, Reese didn't have access to so much as a canoe. Reese had spent some time in South Florida as a kid, but that was decades ago, and that part of the country had changed dramatically since then. Before the war, he and his teammates had conducted demonstrations for the crowds at the UDT SEAL Museum in Fort Pierce, so he did have some semi-local contacts. He'd hit it off while he was down there with some really good local guys who liked to spearfish and had kept in touch with a few via email. Still, he didn't know them well enough to reach out for help as the most wanted man in America, which he suspected he was well on his way to becoming as law enforcement began putting the puzzle together. He also knew that there were some small private airstrips in South Florida where the more entrepreneurial and sophisticated black market businessmen had brought in bales of contraband marijuana, known as Square Grouper, during the 1970s and 80s. But the feds still watched them closely as part of their counter-drug efforts. He couldn't think of another way in that gave him a reasonable chance of getting out, and decided he'd have to rely once again on the generosity of his friend Marco. Reese excused himself and walked out onto the cabin's front porch. He used one of the throwaway phones to reach out to his Mexican benefactor, and sure enough, Marco had contacts in Miami who would arrange for no-questions-asked transportation. There would be a car waiting for him at the FBO at the Opa-locka Airport, northwest of Miami. "So it looks like you won't get to have a man stay overnight after all," he told Liz as he walked back inside.
"Where to then, my fugitive friend?"
"Miami. Then I'll drive down to the Keys. How long would it take us to fly there?" Liz looked toward the ceiling and did some quick math in her head.
"Probably 3.5 hours, depending on the winds."
Reese looked at his watch. "Maybe we will have a sleepover. Too late to pull this off tonight. I need to look at the imagery and do some planning anyway. Does this cavern have a guest room?" Early the next morning, Liz filed a flight plan and they headed for the Sunshine State. Their flight path straddled the white sands of the Gulf Coast and the forgotten shorelines of the Big Bend as the Florida Peninsula arched southward toward the Caribbean. After passing over Sarasota, Riley turned due east, crossing the seemingly endless expanse of islands and Everglades. What looked like a solid wall of sawgrass from ground level appeared more like hundreds of intertwined snakes from above. Small rivers, creeks, and streams ran among clumps of dry or semi-dry land where vegetation grew. Navigating it by water would be nearly impossible. The desolate habitat, far more varied than most believed, was a stark contrast to the highly populated coastlines of Florida that attracted tourists the world over. This must have been what all of South Florida looked like before men came with dredges to turn a sea of grass into a concrete jungle. When hurricanes came to reclaim the ancient swampscape, they built taller levees and deeper canals to hold back the tide of nature. The westernmost barriers of the levee system drew across the state like a line in the sand between raw beauty and manufactured civilization. Cookie-cutter neighborhoods stretched eastward toward the Atlantic and a grid-like maze of asphalt snaked with traffic. Reese stayed in the plane while Liz checked in with the FBO and located his ride, a 2004 Dodge Ram truck with keys under the mat. She returned to the plane and gave Reese a thumbs up.
"Your ride is there, just like your friend said it would be. You sure you don't want me to come along and help out?"
"No, Liz, this is my show. You're sticking your neck out further than I want you to as it is."
"Did you see me getting my head cut off by some hooded asshole on YouTube? No? Oh, yeah, that's because some seal I'd never met before stuck his neck out for me."
"Well, I'm glad I saved your ass back then, because I sure needed you this week."
"Go do what you gotta do and call me if you need a hot extract. There are airfields all over down here. Marathon, Key Largo, Tavernier. There's even a private strip down on Summerlin Key that I could probably talk my way into. You call and I'll be there."
"Liz, I seriously can't thank you enough. I'll see you in a few hours."
"Be safe, Reese. Be safe."
Reese started the truck, cranked the air conditioning, and headed out into the southbound surface streets of Miami. There is the Miami that tourists see, with brilliantly lit skylines, Art Deco architecture, and white sandy beaches. And then there was this one. Much of Miami's population is made up of first or second generation Americans, immigrants from third world, Latin American and Caribbean nations who found refuge in the opportunities offered by Florida's growing economy. The predictable results of that mass transplant are entire neighborhoods that appear to have been plucked from Havana, Bogota, or Port-au-Prince, places where iron bars cover every window and doorway. English is rarely spoken or read, and the occasional chicken, pig, or even cow can be found in an urban backyard. Reese had done some drug interdiction operations as an enlisted SEAL down in South America during the pre-9/11 days, and the sights and sounds of these neighborhoods brought him back to those more innocent times. He made his way south and west onto the Palmetto Expressway, pulling into an aggressive flow of traffic that would give L.A. a run for its money. Reese chuckled as he thought of a trip to Miami a few years earlier when he and some Army special operators staged a mock attack on a prison facility that was set to be demolished. The troops snuck ashore and planted breaching charges to blast their way through the thick concrete walls of the erstwhile correctional facility. When the charges detonated, residents of a nearby housing project thought that they were being raided by SWAT teams and rushed to flush narcotics down the toilets. The effect of hundreds of toilets being flushed nearly simultaneously overwhelmed the utility infrastructure, and it took hours for the area to regain normal water pressure. They probably took more drugs off the street inadvertently that night than the local police would have seized in a month. Reese finally made his way to Florida City and down into the string of islands known as the Keys. The roughly 100-mile chain stretched along the roads and bridges of a single highway, with each mile designated by a numerical marker that counted down to zero as you headed toward Key West. Just about every location in the Keys was referenced by its corresponding mile marker. As you counted down the mile markers and migrated farther south on US 1, you saw fewer signs of Miami's influence and more artifacts of old Florida. The long-standing roadside motels and dive restaurants, relics from the 1950s and 60s, reminded Reese of road trips with his parents and grandparents as a kid. If only his children could have lived to know such carefree days. Chapter 59. Isla Mirada, Florida. Amy Howard was taking an afternoon nap while the kids watched a movie on the large flat-screen television in the living room. Leonard asked the children if they'd like to join him for a walk, but they declined. They were both at the age where they preferred to spend as little time with Mom and Dad as possible, and they were worn out from snorkeling all morning under the Florida sun. Howard wore a wide-brimmed sun hat, lightweight nylon Columbia fishing clothing, and Teva rafting sandals as he walked down the Coquina driveway toward the access road to US 1. A sidewalk paralleled the highway before connecting to a nature trail that offered a dry look at some of the miles of mangrove swamps that formed the core of the local ecosystem. At one point, the trail entered a cathedral of overhanging trees, which provided some welcome shade from the blazing sun. Despite the slow pace and the short distance he'd covered, Howard was already sweating in the oppressive humidity. He couldn't imagine this place in August. As pretty as it was here, he'd take California any day. He heard what sounded like footsteps behind him and turned to see the source of the sound. When he did, he was hit in the jaw by a blow that sent the world to black and him toppling down onto the concrete sidewalk. He awoke with a man astride him, raining blows down on his face. He tried to bring his hands up to block the punches, but his arms were pinned down by a death grip from the man's thighs. Reese had pummeled Howard's face to a bloody pulp, but stopped himself before beating the weaker man to death. That would have been too painless an end for the man who sold Reese's troop out to the Taliban out of pure greed. He took off his leather belt and looped it around Howard's neck like a leash, dragging him off the sidewalk and into the mangrove swamp, the jag crawling behind him as best he could. When they were 50 yards from the trail, Howard's arms gave out and he became dead weight. Reese dropped the belt, letting the man's head fall to the soft ground, before picking the lawyer up in a fireman's carry and wading into the water. The mangroves were like a maze, and Reese had to pay attention to find his way back the way he'd come. He was more than a little relieved when he rounded a corner and saw the bow of the borrowed Hughes Flats boat riding low against the water. He tossed the semi-conscious Howard over the gunwale and bound his hands and feet with flex cuffs for the ride. Off the main chain of islands that were bisected by the highway and railroad were numerous islands of varying sizes and shapes that were accessible only by boat. Reese steered the Hughes northward across the clean waters of Florida Bay, in search of a suitable spot away from the prying eyes and ears of civilization. He didn't have to go far. The shallow draft of the flats boat allowed him to cross over countless underwater obstacles by simply raising the outboard motor. Standing on the poling platform in shorts and a t-shirt and moving the boat with a long fiberglass pole, he looked to any observer like just another angler looking for bonefish in this world-class fishing destination. Reese found a protected cove where he could pull the boat in close to the shore and dropped anchor. The Admiral's jag had regained consciousness and was jabbering on endlessly, taking no responsibility for his part in the plot to kill Reese's troop and family, begging for his life and blaming everyone he could think of for the current predicament. Reese cut the plastic ties binding Howard's feet and tossed the senior officer over the side, watching him flail wildly until he discovered the water was only chest deep. Reese slid over the gunwale and shoved the naval judge advocate toward the mangrove-tangled shoreline. Howard tripped constantly on the exposed roots of the native trees, and it took them what seemed like an eternity to reach the dry, sandy ground of the island. The jag fell to his knees in front of a sable palm tree and began to pray loudly. Reese looked down in disgust at a man who would seek the help of God after sending so many good men to early deaths without remorse. Howard's hat had fallen off somewhere, and Reese attempted to grasp a handful of the man's balding hair, but what was left after the military regulation haircut slipped through his fingers. On his second attempt, Reese grabbed the petrified attorney by the throat and hoisted him skyward, holding an evil-looking blade in the other hand. "Stand the fuck up," he growled as he yanked the captain to his feet and shoved him back against the tree. "I want you to know what's happening to you. You are a traitor, a coward, and a disgrace to the uniform you wore. You served 68 good men up to the enemy on a silver fucking platter so that you could rise alongside that shitty excuse for an admiral. You are the lowest piece of human shit alive. Look at me! Look at me when I talk to you, motherfucker!" Just as his enemy had lost control in their quest for power, Reese lost control and succumbed to the primal need for vengeance, all the emotions of the past several weeks boiling to the surface as he stood in front of the Navy attorney who had facilitated the deaths of his men half a world away.
"I don't know what you're talking about, Reese. I'm just a jag. I don't know what you're saying,"
Howard pled with his eyes closed, blood still streaming down his battered face. His denial sent Reese over the edge with rage. It was time for Howard to die. Reese slashed him across the lower abdomen with the curved blade of his razor-sharp, half-face karambit knife, splitting the lawyer's abdominal wall and sending his intestines spilling out onto the marshy ground. Howard released an animalistic screech and grasped for his bowels, desperately trying to shove them back inside the gaping opening. The wound bled surprisingly little.
"My God! My God!"
were the only words he could muster, repeating them over and over in agony, his pleas for divine intervention going unanswered. Reese showed no mercy, dropping the karambit to the ground and pulling his dynamis razorback belt knife from his waistband. He wielded the knife with violent grace, deftly skewering Howard's intestines with the tip of the blade, but carefully not severing them, then jammed the tip of the knife into the soft, pulpy trunk of the tree, tethering the jag to it with his own entrails. "Walk," Reese said in a calm voice that contrasted sharply from the screams of rage he'd used just seconds earlier. "Walk around this tree or I'll gut your kids while you watch." Leonard Howard stumbled forward in shocked silence, making his way slowly around the tree's circumference, all the while wrapping himself tighter and tighter to the trunk with his own intestines, finally collapsing to the ground, convulsing in tears, with his back against the trunk.
"Please, please, don't leave me here, please,"
he breathed.
"I'll tell you anything you need to know."
"That's just it, Howard," Reese said, leaning in close. "I've already got what I need. Now I'm just going to watch you die."
"I didn't want to..."
"You didn't want to what? You didn't want to kill my troop? You didn't want to kill my wife? My daughter? My son?" "Not good enough, Howard. Not even close. Don't worry, you won't die in vain. Your death serves a purpose. You get to send a message to what's left of your band of conspirators. If you're lucky, you'll go into shock before the rats start eating you alive." Gazing up at his killer, Howard remembered the look Reese had given him back in the Admiral's office in what seemed so long ago. Death
Reese stared into the hollow eyes of the dead man at his feet, his stomach a gaping hole that would provide ample sustenance for the creatures of the swamp. The bowel smell overwhelmed Reese's nostrils. Howard was already attracting flies and mosquitoes. The crows and rats would come next, followed by the crabs. An American crocodile was not out of the question in these parts. He would probably live for several hours as he was slowly eaten alive by the jungle, so long as his heart held out. It would be a couple of days before anyone would find what was left of his body, and that would be just enough time for Reese to prepare the final stages of his plan. Reese wiped his karambit clean on Howard's soaked pant leg and walked swiftly back toward the boat, the seal-designed razorback blade securing Howard to the tree, leaving no question as to the identity of the Jag's executioner. Reese didn't reflect upon what had possessed him to inflict such a ruthless act, but he was a student of warfare. It had come from the deep recesses of his subconscious memory. The Incas had devised this gruesome method of execution centuries ago in order to send a message. North American tribes, including the Shawnee, had used it as well. Sendero Luminoso in Peru adopted it in the 1980s as a brutally effective method to win the minds of locals and dissuade the government from being overly effective in their efforts to eradicate them. While the indigenous tribes and the modern terrorist group did it to strike fear into the souls of those that opposed them, Reese did it as the visceral act of a man overcome by rage. Let those whom he hunted lose sleep wondering if they were to meet with a similar fate. Chapter 60. The drive north was frustrating. The lone artery that runs the length of the Keys was choked with tourists, residents, and fishermen towing boats to various points north. To a man who had just blown up an admiral in his office, shot a federal agent in his bed, decapitated a terrorist, and left a man disemboweled and dying in a mangrove swamp, the stop-and-go traffic was maddening. Reese would be hard to recognize with his hat, sunglasses, and beard, but a driver's license check would bring the full weight of U.S. law enforcement scrambling in his direction. A simple traffic stop would likely result in the end of Reese's mission. He was careful not to speed when the traffic let up enough for that to be a possibility, and he used his turn signals like a teenager trying to pass driver's ed. North of Key Largo, traffic relented a bit, and the flow northward toward Miami put him slightly more at ease. Reese tensed as the truck reached the southern end of Miami's suburban sprawl. Aggressive drivers cut in and out of lanes and, at 3 miles per hour over the posted speed limit, Reese felt like he was driving a farm tractor. He sped up a bit to stay in the flow of traffic, but maintained his position in the right lane. He glanced down at the folded-up map on his lap and prepared to merge onto the Palmetto Expressway for his return to the airfield. As he eased the pickup onto the access road for 826, he was suddenly cut off by a tricked-out orange Honda Civic that looked like a prop car from one of the Fast and Furious movies. He hit the brakes to avoid colliding with the tiny coupe and heard a screech of tires, followed by the crunch of metal and plastic. Reese's head slammed backward in the headrest as the inertia of the rear-end collision pushed his borrowed truck forward and then to a stop. Fuck. It was a hard hit, but Reese was none the worse for wear. I can't believe this whole thing could go south over a fender bender. Think, Reese. You'd better talk your way out of this one. Reese looked in the side mirror to see a morbidly overweight man, roughly his own age, climb down from his lifted Ford Excursion. The driver was walking directly toward Reese's driver's side door, as swiftly as his considerable bulk allowed. Reese took a deep breath and forced a smile as he opened the truck door and stepped out to meet the fast-approaching driver. The other man was within arm's reach by the time Reese had his feet on the ground. Dressed in orange and green Miami Hurricanes athletic shorts and a white tank top that showed off his heavy investment in tattoos, the large man carried himself with the air of a bully, one of those guys who act as if their size comes from muscle rather than fat. He pointed his finger toward Reese's face
and tilted his head forward to look over his mirrored sunglasses. The man's face was red with anger, and spittle flew from his lips as he shouted,
Oye! You wrecked my truck, you gringo maricón!
Reese raised his hands in mock surrender.
Sorry, man, that guy cut me off, and I had to slam on the brakes to keep from crashing into him. I'm sure we can work this out. I've got good insurance. I have no idea who this truck is registered to, or whether it even has insurance. I wonder whether USAA will drop me for being a domestic terrorist.
Their accident was backing up traffic. Horns were blowing, and impatient drivers began crossing the diagonally striped merge lines to drive around them and access the Palmetto. The man stepped even closer to Reese, well inside his reach.
Fuck your insurance, puta. You're gonna pay me for this shit right now, or I'm gonna shoot your fucking ass.
It was doubtful that this guy had a gun in his elastic waistband, but he probably had one in the car.
Easy, friend, easy. Let's just exchange information and get on our way. We don't need to wait around for the cops to come.
A woman, who Reese assumed to be the man's wife or girlfriend, stepped out of the passenger side of the truck, screaming in Spanish and waving her arms. As Reese tried to calm the man down, whatever she was saying appeared to make him even more agitated. She kept pointing at the damage and screaming while Reese pled with the man to relax.
My wife is calling the cops right now. This shit is all your fault.
We don't need to do that, man. I can pay you cash. Just follow me to an ATM.
The driver turned his head to look back at his wife.
Too late,
was all he said before Reese's left arm encircled his antagonist's right arm, tying it up and rendering it useless, while at the same time driving his right hand straight up, palm open, into the underside of the man's chin. The force of Reese's blow broke the jaw and destroyed what was probably a bad set of teeth anyway, but more important, it caused the man's brain to hit the back of his skull and bounce back inside his head, sending a shockwave through his nervous system and knocking him immediately unconscious. The man's knees buckled and gravity sent all 380 pounds directly downward. His head smashed on the asphalt street with a sickening thunk. His female companion jumped from the car screaming, a phone pressed to her ear. Reese leapt into the driver's seat of his truck and pulled the shift lever down into drive. He slammed on the accelerator and felt the truck strain as the tires spun, barely moving forward. The accident had entangled the two heavy vehicles into one gigantic train of steel. Reese put the Dodge in neutral, pressed a button on the left side of the dash to engage the four-wheel drive, and put the truck into its lowest gear. He accelerated forward, dragging the heavier Ford SUV behind him as the engine raced to produce enough torque. He knew he couldn't travel far this way, but for now it was all he had.
I've got to get out of this truck.
He drove up the sweeping overpass toward the expressway, leaving the fat man's hysterical wife behind, and glanced down at the map to determine his next move. The map gave him an idea. As he reached the middle of a long turn, he swerved right and then left as he slammed on the brakes. The two trucks slid into position, blocking both lanes of the highway overpass from one concrete guardrail to the other. He engaged the parking brake on the Dodge and put the keys and map into his pocket. He slid over the bench seat to the passenger side and grabbed his backpack from the floorboard as he opened the passenger door. Horns were already blowing as he climbed over the guardrail and dangled from the edge.
Fuck me.
Reese released his grip, dropped his chin to his chest, and placed his feet and bent knees together to prepare for what was surely to be a painful impact. It had been almost 20 years since the Army Black Hat instructors at Fort Benning had taught Reese the parachute landing fall, or PLF for short. But there are some things that you never forget. The balls of his feet hit the gravel and he rolled to his side, distributing the impact of the fall from his feet onto his calves, thighs, hips, and back. The technique, developed to allow rapidly descending parachutists to avoid injury, also worked well for a man on the run to drop from a highway overpass onto the rail bed below. Reese's body had endured lots of wear and tear since his jump school days as a young SEAL, and he lay still for a moment to assess his body's condition. He felt hurt, not injured. So he rolled into the prone position and up into a kneel. His right knee buckled slightly as he put his weight on it, but he was able to hobble forward with minimal pain. None of the commuters seemed to notice or care that a man had climbed onto the Metro Rail platform from the rails below. They were all too engrossed in their smartphones. A young boy did notice, but when he tried to tell his mother that a man had fallen from the sky and landed on the tracks, she nodded at him while continuing her online shopping spree. Dade Land was the commuter rail system's terminus, and a train arrived after less than a minute of waiting. If anyone outside Miami had ever heard of Dade Land, it was probably because of the 1979 Dade Land Massacre, a bloody shootout in a parking lot that came to symbolize Miami's epidemic of drug violence. Reese hoped there wasn't going to be a second bloody shootout in Dade Land, but he was ready just in case. He unzipped the backpack to allow him access to his handgun and held the bag down at his left side as he stepped onto the train. The entire side of the Metro Rail car was painted with a Wi-Fi advertisement, which prompted Reese to retrieve his iPhone from the back pocket of his pack. He prayed they hadn't found a way to track it, but he had no choice other than the burner phone he was saving for a last resort. He powered up the device, connected to the Wi-Fi signal, and opened the Signal app. Had to ditch the truck on the metro heading north from the Dade Land Station Green Line. Need to plan an extract soon. Cops probably looking for me. Liz Riley must have been looking at her phone since her response came back almost immediately.
I'll make a plan. Wait one.
Reese pulled the map out of his pocket and began looking at options. The seal in him told him to go to the water, but there didn't appear to be a maritime route to an airfield unless he could get a hold of a boat. He looked up, hearing sirens, but they were headed away from him toward the crash scene. His phone vibrated.
Unless you have to bail, stay on the Green Line until the Okeechobee Station. Looks like 20 stops. I'll get a ride and pick you up there.
Reese consulted the station map on the wall of the metro car and looked down at the map. Shit, I'm going to be stuck on this damn train forever. Okay, I'll let you know if I have to divert. What are you driving? If it gets hot, leave me and I'll make my own way. Reese moved to the front of the car and leaned against the corner so that he could see the entire space. Everyone appeared to be engrossed in their phones and no one paid him any attention. Apparently, between the beard, the ball cap, and the sunglasses, he wasn't recognizable from the media reports he assumed must be out by now, though he had yet to see any. As the train worked its way north, Reese examined the South Miami landscape, keeping a sharp eye out for any sign of law enforcement activity. Then it was through the University of Miami campus, passing next to the baseball field. He breathed a sigh of relief every time the doors shut and the train continued northward. The tracks paralleled US 1 and took Reese north through downtown Miami and its towering skyscrapers. Reese couldn't believe how the city's skyline had changed since his last visit here. The ride continued through some slum areas north of downtown before turning westward into mainly residential areas. From the train, Reese could view the roofs of tract homes arranged in perfect grids as far as the eye could see. The scene reminded him a bit of some of the crowded cityscapes that he'd seen in places like Baghdad and Manila. After a painfully long train ride, the station diagram indicated that Reese was one stop away from Okeechobee. He pulled the iPhone out and saw that he had a message alert. He logged back into Signal and saw a new message from Liz.
Out front, black Honda minivan, all clear.
Reese scanned the area around the approaching station as much as possible through the train's windows. The car came to a stop and the doors jolted open. A few passengers disembarked quickly and fewer still brushed past them to board the train without a sliver of courtesy or patience. Reese had figured out the timing of the stops after enduring station after station, staring intently at the screen of his phone as the passengers came and went. When he knew he had a second or two before the doors began to close, he feigned surprise and sprinted off the car. Anyone who had been shadowing him from inside the train would be heading off to the next station without him. A quick glance back at the platform confirmed that no one had exited behind him. Reese pulled his hat down tight to remain as protected as possible from any facial recognition cameras that might be at the station. Grant money from Homeland Security had helped create a surveillance state in population centers across the nation, and mass transit systems were some of the most popular sites. The rail platform was elevated above ground level, which allowed Reese a good vantage point from which to observe the area. Looking over the rail, he spotted Liz's borrowed minivan idling next to the curb below. Nothing appeared out of the ordinary, but this was exactly the kind of choke point where ambushes took place. Rhys made up his mind that if things went bad, he would not involve Liz any further. She'd done more than enough by now and had long since repaid her debt. He had a hunch that